From claims of healings and visions to the world's most inexplicable events, whether you're a believer or a skeptic, the truth is always worth the hunt.
EWTN Radio presents The Miracle Hunter with Michael O'Neill.
Welcome to The Miracle Hunter Radio Show on EWTN Radio. I'm Elizabeth Ficicelli. I'm a Catholic author, speaker, and radio host filling in for Michael O'Neill today. I've been on the show many times and have filled in for him as host. I'm delighted to do so today. So you might be asking, where is Michael? And that's a great question. He is actually traveling to France to film some new episodes of Explore with the Miracle Hunter. And you can find out more about Explore with the Miracle Hunter at explorewiththemiraclehunter.com. And these new episodes he's going to be filming this week, he's going to be going to places like Lisieux. That's the home birthplace of one of my favorite saints, Saint Thérèse of Lisieux. He'll be going to La Salette, where the apparitions took place high in the French Alps up there. Recamadour. Recamadour is the home of the Black Virgin, and of course, he'll be down at Mount Saint-Michel. That's a very popular pilgrimage destination in France. And he is also going to Lourdes, home of another one of my spiritual girlfriends, Saint Bernadette. And it's kind of exciting. He's going to be granted access to the Lourdes Medical Bureau, and that's where they investigate all the physical miracles that happen at Lourdes. He's doing that for a 2022 EWTN documentary called Miracle of Lourdes. And I write and speak on Lourdes and Saint Bernadette. My book is Lourdes, Font of Faith, Hope, and Charity. So it's a real interesting process of how they authenticate miracles. So I talk about that in my book, but that is a documentary I'm going to want to see, Miracles of Lourdes. That'll be coming out in 2022. And speaking of books, Michael has a new book out this week, so you want to check into that. It's called They Might Be Saints, On the Path to Sainthood in America. And he features 24 blesseds and venerables, and this is a book available on at the EWTN Religious Catalog, which you can access, of course, at EWTNRC.com. Now, just because Michael is traveling, he's not here today, we're still going to have all the great stuff that you expect from the show, so don't worry about that. So let me just tell you quickly what's coming up this hour. Like we always do, we have 365 Days with Mary Project, and today we're going to be looking at the Virgin of Akathistos in Mount Athos, Greece. Another segment we'll have is Might Be Saint of the Day, Americans on the Path to Sainthood. And we're going to be looking today at Blessed Severinus Boethius from Rome. And then we always have a question of the week. It's sent in by a listener, and today's question we'll be addressing a little bit later in the hour is, why do stigmatics get wounds in their hands while others get them in their wrists? So we'll attempt an answer at that one this hour. And now it's time for Miracle News. You know, each week we try to update you on current stories of miracles, because the fact is miracles do happen in our day and age. So here's an update on the apparitions of Our Lady in Simbras, Pernambuco, Brazil, an apparition that took place on August 6th, 1936. If you're unfamiliar with this apparition from the 1930s, it involved two teenage girls who saw the Virgin in a cleft in the rock, and she spoke to them. She had a message of suffering and punishment that was going to come to the people there. Specifically, she talked about the spread of communism in Brazil, and that if Brazilians didn't convert and repent and do penance, Our Lady said Brazil would have a civil war almost as bloody as the Spanish one, which had just taken place in history. And here's the thing. Apparently, guess what? The people listened and responded, and therefore they averted the chastisements to that country. And that's pretty amazing to me, because that doesn't always happen. We saw that in Fatima and repeatedly, where she gave the warnings and people didn't heed it. Another miracle that happened, by the way, with these apparitions is that water started flowing from the rock where the Virgin was standing, and that would lead to healing. So it's kind of like the miracle of Lourdes with the water. And also footprints of an adult and child were left in the rock that can still be seen today, and the Virgin said those were hers and footprints of her son. So the update that happened regarding these apparitions of Our Lady in Simbras, Pernambuco, Brazil, it happened just the other day, October 4th, this month. The bishop there, Bishop Jose Salas of the Diocese of Pesqueira in the state of Pernambuco, Brazil, released a pastoral letter recognizing the great probability of the supernatural character of the experience lived by the seers, and authorized the local devotion to Our Lady of the Grace. And he also requested the Neil Obstott from the Congregation for the Causes of Saints, authorizing the official opening of the beatification and canonization process of Sister Adelia. And she's one of the seers, so that's a very important step forward for those apparitions. And now it's time for Catholic Pub Trivia. You know, each week, Michael asks a trivia question, and he gives out a prize to the emailer who writes in the fastest with the correct answer. And last week on the show, they were talking about a fascinating new book called Angel Encounters, published by Sophia Institute Press. He wanted me to give you the website because there was apparently some interest in that book. You can find out more about that at sophiainstitute.com. But because the topic was angels, the question last week, the Catholic pub trivia question was, which angels are mentioned by name in the Bible? And some of the correct answers could include Gabriel, Michael, Raphael, Uriel, and even Lucifer, because Lucifer is mentioned by name. He was an angel of light originally before he went over to the dark side. So those answers were correct. And the question for this week, since Michael, I thought, was visiting the Medical Bureau over in Lourdes, that the question could be this. How many healing miracles associated with Lourdes have been approved by the Catholic Church? How many miracles associated with Lourdes have been approved by the Catholic Church? So if you know the answer, you can email your answer in right now, and you could win an image of the faces of Mary. So we need to take a short break, but when we come back, we're going to be talking to our first guest, Dr. Paul Thigpen, on spiritual warfare. Stay tuned.
Now, back to the Miracle Hunter on EWTN. Here's Michael O'Neill.
And welcome back to the Miracle Hunter on EWTN Radio. I'm Elizabeth Ficicelli, Catholic author, speaker, and radio host, filling in for Michael O'Neill today, who's over in France filming new episodes of Explore with the Miracle Hunter. You know, spiritual warfare, as I said at the top of the program, is very timely because I think we're seeing it play out on a grand scale in modern times. And I do a presentation on this topic through the lens of our Blessed Mother, who in her many apparitions through history warns us of this battle and instructs us to take up arms. And that talk is called Spiritual Warfare in the Age of Mary, and you can check it out on my website, elizabethficicelli.com. So I'm really pleased to be joined right now by a true expert in the subject of spiritual warfare. He's Dr. Paul Thigpen. He's a best-selling author and award-winning journalist. He's published, believe it or not, 58 books, more than 500 journal and magazine articles. And he's just traveled the world. His work's been translated into 12 languages. He's a historian, apologist, evangelist, catechist, speaking at conferences and seminars and parish missions, like I said, all over the U.S. and abroad. And today he is joining us to talk about spiritual warfare. So welcome, Dr. Thigpen, to the show.
Thank you, Elizabeth. Great to be here.
It is great. So I understand that Tan Books has produced fairly recently a multiple-part video series by you entitled Introduction to Spiritual Warfare. And as I was just saying, I think it's so timely, this topic, because not just because the warfare maybe is getting more and more intense, or at least more visible to us, but I think there's a lot of people who still don't see it or understand it. And it's such a personal battle. So first of all, give us an overview of the project and what inspired you to create it. And then we can talk more about some of the specifics.
You know, Elizabeth, I've written about this, you know, several books before the series, because I've had experiences in my own life. In fact, that some of the more extraordinary activity of the devil that I encountered as a teenager is part of what brought me from atheism into the Christian faith and ultimately the Catholic faith. So that's, you know, and then since that time, I've had many experiences, people coming to me with experiences. But that's really what all along has kind of prompted me with this. It's not always the happiest subject to write about. And yet, as you said, so many folks are still unaware of what's going on. It's like they're out on a battlefield with bullets whizzing by them, and they have no clue. And that's part of the devil's stealth strategy, is if we don't believe that he's there or don't even think about him, then he can get away with all kinds of stuff. So that's really the reason for doing this series. A manual for spiritual warfare, also with Tan, and a book called Saints Who Battle Satan and Spiritual Warfare Bible, they've all been, have had lots of fruit, I think, among the readers. So we thought, well, we need to bring it to the screen as well. And that's what we've done here.
And I love the fact that this is a video series because, you know, I've authored books myself. I love books, but I think video series are really good right now. You know, we just came out of this pandemic year. There were so many people kind of isolated in their homes, and we've had programs like Formed and such that had been able to provide people with stuff like these videos and so forth that people can watch. And then not only for your individual viewing, but great for parish group studies. You know, we've done so many videos in the parishes I've been a part of. And so this is wonderful that you're providing it in a video form as well. So let's kind of talk about this, because I know you're sort of hinting about this, you know, that we do have an enemy. We have to know we have an enemy and who that is. And we have to know we're in a battle, because like I said, a lot of people don't know that. And we have to know how you fight spiritual warfare, because it's not like you fight material warfare, you know, not with guns and bombs and drones. It's different. So first of all, talk about our enemy, Satan. You know, what kind of powers does he actually have?
Well, to answer that question, we have to remember, first of all, what he is by his nature. He is a fallen angel. And he, of course, led the rebellion against God in heaven, a third of the angels himself. And so when we understand that, understand what an angel is, we know more about what he can and can't do. He and other demons have great powers far beyond ours in terms of intelligence and even physical powers, or the power to affect physical things in our lives. Much smarter than we are, much craftier than we are. But in the end, we have to remember he's only a creature, and that God's much more powerful, who's on our side. And so he has to, you know, one of the important things I think we have to remember, especially in fighting the battle of temptation, his ordinary activity, is that because the demons don't have bodies, and we usually recognize thoughts coming to us from outside ourselves through, you know, physical means, through our senses, he can speak directly into our mind and try to influence our thoughts, our memory, imagination, eventually our will. So that's always, you know, an important thing to keep in mind, that he does have the power to speak directly into us, our minds, and to sometimes trick us into thinking it's our own thoughts.
So would that be considered then some of his typical battle strategies? Temptation, certainly. And what else?
Well, I think temptation is kind of the big category for, if you're talking about, the church traditionally distinguishes between the ordinary activities of the demon and the extraordinary. The extraordinary is the kind of stuff we may talk about, but that Hollywood likes to make so much of. The ordinary is what every Christian, every person battles every day, and that is temptation. So what are we tempted to? And his strategies are to tempt us to things like, well, first of all, deception. He tempts us through deception. He tempts us to doubt God. He kind of bullies us by accusation. He uses provocation to things like lust and wrath and even despair. He uses every wile that he has to try to provide what, you know, an occasion to sin for us. He can't coerce us into doing these things, but he can make it a whole lot easier that we give into them.
And then, so that would be ordinary demonic activity. And then what would be extraordinary demonic activity?
Yeah, extraordinary, you know, like I said, this is the kind of stuff Hollywood makes so much of, and yet it's very real. Would be things like demonic infestation, mm-hmm. When, you know, preternatural things are happening associated with a particular location, place, or thing. Obsession. And oppression, you can kind of divide up the pie in different ways, but much of that has to do with the interior life, but some of it also has, oppression has to do with physical things that can happen to someone when there's, you know, you've got some doors open there to demonic influence, so physical assault, even that kind of thing. But persistent temptation to suicide, hearing voices, hallucinations can even be, and we always have to keep in mind, the church says that before we would discern that this is a spiritual matter, we have to rule out first all the medical matters that could be. But then finally, possession, the most rare and yet becoming less rare occasion is where a person has temporary periodic episodes in which the demon takes over their body, can do things through them, can speak through them. But typically, the person who's the victim of that doesn't remember when it's all over. They come to and say, where am I? What, you know, what's happened? So that would be the right example of, you know, the indication of the most serious kind of activity, possession.
So Dr. Thigpen, as you said before, that temptation is kind of the first line of battle in this, that these other things that you mentioned, obsession and oppression and possession, they're less common. But all of us face temptation on a daily basis. That's kind of his first line of attack. So that's where we have to be vigilant to stop it then and there before it can progress further. But as people are listening to this conversation, you know, maybe they're thinking, well, wait a minute, because Jesus Christ conquered the enemy through the cross. And I thought the enemy was thwarted by this. So, you know, how can the enemy still have power, and how can we claim Jesus' victory for ourselves?
You know, Jesus did decisively defeat the enemy at Calvary, where he died, and then again when he rose again, especially. And yet, the battle continues in the sense that it's almost like a mop-up operation. Think about the Second World War, how there were decisive defeats in Europe over the enemy, but still you had some other things that had happened over in Asia. Maybe that's one analogy we might offer. But the thing is, he allows for now the battle to go on still on this earth, because the battle is part of what tests us. It's part of what makes us strong and more like him in holiness and making the right choices, especially when we're tempted, so that we can then one day have a share in his victory in heaven. But I think it was St. Augustine who once said that as an artist, God uses even the devil. And so we have to understand that the mystery of evil still is a mystery in many ways. But for sure, God allows the devil to continue to work, because his plan is for us to resist the devil, to become strengthened in virtue by that, and ultimately to be conformed to the image of Christ.
Absolutely. Are we alone in fighting this spiritual battle?
Oh, I love to say that there's an entire army, and we have what I would call three divisions in that. Of course, the commander of it all is our Lord Jesus Christ. But then he has also given us in battle Our Lady, his mother, who I like to think of not just as our Blessed Mother, but also as a warrior queen. She's certainly the queen of the angels. And the exorcists will tell you that the demons are terrified of her, and even of her name. They're terrified of the Hail Mary prayer. And so we have her to rely on, but we also have the first division, all the other saints, those who have gone on to heaven. That's why we call them the church triumphs, that they've already won their battle, and they can help us in many ways, not just through intercession, but other ways as well. That's why in a major exorcism in that rite, the litany of saints is a part of it, to call on their help. Second division then, of course, is angels, St. Michael being the greatest force in this battle, but also our guardian angels and others. And then third are our fellow Christians. St. Paul once referred to fellow Christians as fellow soldiers. And I think we have to remember that we've got to fight this battle with each other. We've got to have each other's back in the battle, because we're all in this together. We are the church militant, the church that is still fighting.
That's right. Strength in numbers. Now, we don't fight this battle, like I said, with guns and drones and tanks. We have to have spiritual weapons in a spiritual battle. So what are those spiritual weapons?
Well, we have to, of course, start with prayer. I think that's the indispensable weapon. And when Jesus taught us in the Our Father, lead us not into temptation, there's the enemy's activity, but deliver us from evil. You can also translate that to evil one. So in his model prayer, we're supposed to pray against evil. But within that, then we keep in mind that the name of Jesus is especially powerful. Jesus himself said that in his name we would cast out demons. Weapon, worship, you wouldn't think of it as a weapon, but it's definitely a place where the devil doesn't want to follow us. Eucharistic adoration, I think it was St. John Bosco used to say, it's one of our greatest weapons. Fasting, sacred scripture, you look at how Jesus encountered the devil in the wilderness. He prepared for that encounter through prayer and fasting himself. When he did engage the enemy, then he used scripture to do that. Of course, the sacraments. I mean, we could talk about those forever, but the Eucharist is most important. It's the place, it's Jesus himself and the place where the devil was defeated. But then confession is so important. Reconciliation, that's like our field hospital. Sacramentals, things like holy water, that kind of thing, blessed metals. So many stories from the saints about how sacramental help is in this battle. So those are our weapons, and then kind of our defensive armor are the virtues.
The virtues. That's awesome. And yes, your list is complete. Those are all the same ones I have too. So we have them at our fingertips. We just have to use them. So last question for you, Dr. Thigpen, how do we keep this enemy out of our camp?
Oh my, that's, there's an increase in the number of possessions and this kind of stuff going on. One reason why now the church is having to train some of the exorcists in America, not just send them off to Rome. And the exorcists I talked to say there are kind of two reasons why the demand for exorcists has gone up. And that one is so many people now are secular people, have none of the sacraments. They don't pray. They don't have faith. All the things that we've just talked about, they don't have. Many of them don't even have baptism. So they're extremely vulnerable. But at the same time, it's like a double whammy. More of them are getting involved in things that invite the enemy into the camp, that kind of open the doors to enemy influence. That would be things like occult activity, whether it's witchcraft or Ouija boards or trying to contact the dead, channeling, that kind of thing. It can be certain types of very serious sin can also open the door. So we have to keep the enemy out of our camp. St. Paul said, give no place to the devil. And we can't be like the folks in Troy who welcomed the Trojan horse in because they thought it was a great idea, but it was actually a catastrophe waiting to happen.
That's right. That's right. Boy, that was great. That is a great synopsis. The video series, Introduction to Spiritual Warfare. It's Dr. Paul Thigpen. That comes out from Tan Books. And that sounds awesome. Something that you really want to look into. Dr. Thigpen, if someone's interested in that particular project, where can they go?
Go to tanbooks.com. That's the best place.
All right. And I know you said retired or starting retirement, but any projects you're working on, or where can people find you if they want to see what's kind of your body of work?
Oh, my goodness. Well, most of my recent books are with Tan, so that's a good place to look. Amazon, okay. I've got an author page. But yes, I'm working on two more books, both of which have to be done by the end of December. I won't say what the present one is, but the next one's really exciting because it's a bit of a secret. But the next one will be A Life of St. Joseph as Seen by the Mystics.
Nice.
So I'm really, really excited about this.
And this is, of course, the year of St. Joseph. And he is he's another great one for spiritual warfare, by the way. He's another powerhouse that we can turn to. So thank you so much for joining us. Great conversation. And we look forward to your next coming books.
Thanks, Elizabeth. I appreciate you having me on. God bless you and all your listeners.
God bless you, too. We need to take a short break now, but when we come back, we're going to try to answer that question of the week. Why do some stigmatics get wounds in their hands while others get them in their wrists? So stay tuned.
Now, back to the Miracle Hunter. On EWTN, here's Michael O'Neill.
So welcome back to The Miracle Hunter on EWTN Radio. I'm Elizabeth Ficicelli, filling in for Michael O'Neill today. He's over in France, filming some new episodes of Explore with The Miracle Hunter. And I know that Michael loves getting your questions. People write in from around the world with questions about miracles happening either in today's modern world or those that have happened centuries ago. And this is a really interesting question. It says, Dear Miracle Hunter, why do some stigmatics get wounds in their hands and others get them in their wrists? Doesn't the fact that they manifest differently prove that this is a psychological manifestation? Thank you. And that's from Thomas. So a couple things. Well, first of all, about his question, does this prove that it's a psychological manifestation? You know, they have done a lot of psychological studies where they will put these patients with stigmata under hypnosis, and they try to suggest and, you know, force them, in other words, to manifest wounds. But there's never been one case in this scenario where a patient has been able to manifest a non-superficial wound. So from that, we can conclude it is not a psychosomatic phenomena. It's not something that happens under the power of suggestion. It's happening in another realm that we don't fully understand. So it's not just because some may have wounds one way or another. That doesn't necessarily mean this is just something coming out of a figment of their imagination. And we know that mystics have different of appearances of these wounds. Some have had the five classic wounds, you know, the ones in the hands, the feet, and the chest. Some have had the crown of thorns. I think of St. Rita of Cassia. She had one thorn mark in her forehead. Or Teresa Neumann in Germany had 60 lash marks on her back, which was kind of unusual. And some saints, like Thomas said in his question, can have stigmata in their hands, famously like St. Padre Pio, St. Francis, but others have had it in the wrists, and that's kind of depicted on the Shroud of Turin. We see the wound marks on the wrist. So, you know, why this variability? Well, I remember when I wrote about St. Rita's case, that she, in her life, was really drawn to Christ's passion, and particularly in his crown of thorns, and she had desired to share in his passion in some way. So maybe this is why, in her particular case, you know, her stigmata only manifested on her forehead. So it may be related to having a focus on one particular aspect of the patient, of the passion, rather. It may be a question for God when we get to heaven, but to me, it seems that God meets the mystic halfway. He's always meeting us halfway. And the way that the person envisions the passion of the Christ is, you know, in their prayer life, maybe how it results and how it manifests. So maybe they were familiar with a particular piece of artwork in history that depicted the wounds of Christ in a particular way, and they related to it personally. You know, really, the truth is, Thomas, we can only speculate. It may always be a mystery. So we want to thank Thomas for his question. And if you have a question for the Miracle Hunter, send an email to miraclehunter@ewtn.com or go to the website miraclehunter.com and send a message there. And maybe Michael will be reading your question on the air next week. And now it's time for 365 Days of Mary Project. So today we're going to be looking at the Virgin of Akathistos in Mount Athos, Greece. Turn back the dial to the year 1276. And originating in Constantinople in this time, in the 6th century, the Akathistos is a long sequence of praises to the Mother of God. And as the story goes, one day in 1276, there was a hermit, and he was repeating the Akathistos, as was his custom, before an icon of the Virgin and Child at his dwelling near the Bulgarian monastery of Zagrafo. And he heard the Virgin speak, and she said, "Don't be afraid, but go quickly to tell the abbot and the monks that the enemy is near." And she continued, "The faint-hearted should escape, but those who wish a martyr's crown should stay." And that's pretty ominous. And when the hermit arrived at the gate of the monastery, to his surprise, the icon was waiting for him. And the abbot was given the Virgin's warning. And soon the Catalan crusaders arrived. They set fire to the tower of the monastery, making Orthodox martyrs of 26 people that remained inside. And that took place on October 23rd. Or October 10th in the old calendar. It's now time for Sainthood News. And each week we'd like to report on the sainthood news happening in the church to keep you up to date on what new saints are being canonized or who's coming down the pipeline. On October 13th this month, Pope Francis received His Eminence Cardinal Marcello Semeraro. He's the prefect of the Congregation for the Causes of Saints, in a private audience. And during that audience, the Holy Father authorized the congregation to promulgate a decree regarding the miracle attributed to the intercession of the venerable saint of God, Anna Julia Duke Heckner, religious name, Sister Maria Berenice. She was the founder of the Congregation of the Little Sisters of the Annunciation. She was born in Salamina, Caldas, which is Colombia. In August of 1898, she died in Medellin, in Antioquia, Colombia, in July 1993, so not too long ago. And her heroic virtues were confirmed on February 12, 2019. So remember, to be elevated from venerable to blessed requires an approved miracle. So in the case of Sister Maria Berenice, it's Sebastian Vasquez Sierra. He's a young man who was 20 years old, who was detected with a degenerative disease, which was causing his body little by little to be immobilized. And he lived in the neighborhood of Medellin, where she died. And he was even contemplating the possibility of hastening his own death to avoid the pain he was in. He was really suffering. He was in a coma twice. However, someone sent him a book and a prayer from Sister Maria Berenice, and he read them, and he began to feel a miraculous improvement that eventually lifted him out of bed, and he was able to start walking. And this miracle is now officially accepted, so Saint Berenice will become blessed. And of course, another miracle, a second miracle, will be required for sainthood, and that's how the process goes. Our next segment is Might Be Saint of the Day, and this segment of the show connects with Michael's weekly EWTN series, They Might Be Saints, about Americans on the path to sainthood and the search for the canonization miracles. So as the show says, from miracle workers to martyrs and to those ordinary people living extraordinary lives of heroic virtue, these are the people who make us wonder if someday they might be saints. And you can watch that show, by the way, They Might Be Saints. It airs Fridays at 5 p.m. Eastern on EWTN, and you can find out more about that at theymightbesaints.com. So in this program, we look at servants of God, venerables, and blesseds whose feast day or death anniversary lines up with today's date on the calendar. And today we have Blessed Severinus Boethius. He was born 475 in Rome, Italy. He was the descendant of a Roman consular family, and his father was chosen as consul in 487, but died soon after, leaving Severinus an orphan. Severinus was educated by a pious aristocratic friend of the family. He was fluent in Greek. He probably studied in Athens, Greece, or Alexandria, Egypt. He was known for his education and his intellect. He married Rusticana, the daughter of his mentor. They had two sons. Severinus lived as a Roman consul in 510. His sons were also chosen as consuls themselves. And Severinus was an aide and a confidant to King Theodoric. He was known as a philosopher and a writer. And then things took a turn. Political rivals began to accuse him of disloyalty to the throne, of plotting to restore the republic, and of the sacrilege of astrology. So he was imprisoned without trial. While he was in jail, it's interesting, he made use of that time. He reflected on the instability of a state whose government depended on a single man, such as a king. And he developed those ideas in his best-known work, Consolations of Philosophy. Soon after, he was executed on order of King Theodoric. And a tradition began soon after that he'd really been imprisoned and killed for being an Orthodox Catholic. And he was soon considered a martyr, and he died in the year 524 or 525 in Pavia, Italy. That's where you can see his relics in the cathedral there. And he was beatified by Pope Leo XIII in 1883. We need to take a short break right now, but when we come back, we're going to be talking with Father George Eliot about another great topic, Eucharistic miracles. Stay tuned for that.
Now, back to the Miracle Hunter on EWTN. Here's Michael O'Neill.
And welcome back to the Miracle Hunter on EWTN Radio. I'm Elizabeth Ficicelli, filling in for Michael O'Neill, who is over in France filming episodes of Explore with the Miracle Hunter. You know, Eucharistic miracles is a fascinating subject. It's a topic I address in one of my 15 books for adults and young people called Bleeding Hands, Weeping Stone. You can find out more about my books and presentations at elizabethficicelli.com. But in the meantime, I'm really delighted to bring on our next guest to talk about Eucharistic miracles. He is Father George Eliot, a frequent guest on EWTN. He's a priest from the Diocese of Tyler, Texas, and the founder and director of Catholic Cast Media. Thanks for joining us today, Father Eliot.
Thank you for having me, Elizabeth.
It's a pleasure. You know, I looked you up and I see you are, well, I would regard you as one of our younger priests ordained in 2015. And I host a show called Answering the Call for St. Gabriel Catholic Radio in Ohio, where I interview priests about their journeys. So I'm always interested in that. So before we talk about the subject at hand, can you give us just a 1 minute rendition of, because I'm always curious about these younger priests that have heard the call and answered it in a time when our church is kind of troubled, you know, so it's great to see vocations flourishing. But what was it, if you had to like really summarize it, that drew you to the priesthood?
Yeah, I think it was, I mean, ultimately it's the call of God, right? The real mystery, and God calls who he wills. But what really drew me to the priesthood was a real love of the Eucharist that developed in Eucharistic adoration. My home parish had 24/7 Eucharistic adoration, and my mom, she got Catholic guilted into being one of the hourly captains for the afternoon. And so whenever somebody couldn't find a substitute, my mom would just send me. She said, go take the car, go. it was really just there before our Lord and the Blessed Sacrament that my love for the Eucharist grew. And then also I had a priest that really consistently preached the importance of confession. And so between that love for the Eucharist and then, experiencing the freedom and the joy that comes from the sacrament of confession, I realized, you know what, I could absolutely dedicate my life to this.
Wow, and certainly two powerful avenues of grace there, adoration and confession. So tell us what Cast Media is and how that has been received.
Yes, Cast Media is a Catholic media company that focuses on evangelization on digital platforms. So when I was a seminarian at the North American College in Rome, it was actually a friend of mine approached me and said, hey, you know, there are several of these podcasts that really have a lot of demand. It seems something that seems to be something that, you know, a lot of Catholics are desiring right now. And we've got all of these really bright people here at the North American College, but they're all in Italy. And so let's start a podcast and get their voices back home. And actually at that time I said, oh, no way. I'm not starting a podcast. I'm not interested. And then I was ordained a deacon while this other seminarian that had approached me, now Father Greg Gerhardt, and he was on a pastoral year. And so I was ordained a deacon, and I think just the grace of orders started working in me and realizing that, you know, it was my duty to proclaim the gospel. And so I came back to him and I said, hey, you know, I think I want to start this podcast. And he said, oh, no way. but a friend of ours just happened to hear the conversation and said, you know, I've actually been thinking about doing a similar thing. So the three of us kind of banded together and started Catholic Bites podcast. And then kind of one thing led to another. And we had some lay people that started working with us. And when we all finished up our time in Rome and we're going back to the U.S., those lay people approached us and said, hey, you know, we want to kind of make this a full-time gig. And so we started Cast Video Studio, which makes high-quality, mostly institutional and development videos that are kind of story-based for different dioceses and Catholic institutions across the U.S. And then also we ended up taking on CatholicLink.org, which is the English side of the Catholic Link website that produces articles, images, and quotes really for social media and for resources for the new evangelization, just to kind of fill the internet with good quality content, just to, you know, join the battle trying to bring the internet back from the precipice.
Yeah, well, you know, I think, Father, you're really right about evangelization taking place on a digital platform today. That's imperative. I'm sure Fulton Sheen would have been gobbling up that opportunity if he was alive today. You know, that's where people are. That's where you have to reach them. So I did check out your Catholic Cast Media and great provocative topics. So thank you for doing that. So important in the age of the new evangelization. So let's get to the topic at hand, though. Eucharistic miracles. You know, you told us that you were drawn through adoration as one of the avenues God really touched you. And that is the Blessed Sacrament. That is the Eucharist right there. But the subject of Eucharistic miracles, this isn't something reserved for the Middle Ages. They continue to happen in our day and age. Why do you think that is?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. In a lot of the stories of Eucharistic miracles, it almost starts off with, there was this priest who was struggling with his faith in the Eucharist. And, you know, I think with the trends of this kind of overemphasis in science that then kind of creates this hyper-faith in our own senses, that trend has created a situation for us in the 21st century in which it's hard to believe in the Eucharist. You know, it requires a real act of faith. And our Lord in these Eucharistic miracles really kind of just gives us that extra little bit of help, saying, yep, you know what? It's still me. I'm still present. I know you all are a little bit too tied up in your senses, but trust my word. This is the chalice of my blood.
And Father, you mentioned about the science and stuff. I would think that, well, a couple of things. You know, first of all, we read these statistics of Catholics who don't understand or believe in the real presence. I would think that the scientific studies that regarding Eucharistic miracles that have been coming out in the last couple of decades would be kind of a wake-up call, like, this really is real. Here's the science for you people who are struggling with this belief. But, you know, do you agree with that?
Yeah, you know, actually, I think one of the reasons why I'm really excited about this book coming out is that Dr. Stacy Trosankos, who has a doctorate in chemistry, wrote the section on the Eucharistic miracles And we kind of tag-teamed the book. It's divided up. The first section is the biblical proofs for the Eucharist. Then it's the patristic, the early church testimony about their faith in the Eucharist. And then it's an analysis of the Eucharistic miracles. And what Dr. Trasankos got in and found was that, okay, yeah, no, there's without a doubt some stuff happening here. But some of the scientific claims that have been made are not completely tenable from a very, very strict scientific view. And I have to admit, whenever I heard that, I had spoken to her because I had read, you know, all of these articles out here where, you know, all of these scientists are claiming these things. I thought, oh, great, we'll get this chemist that'll come in and she'll just repeat everything that everybody else has been saying. And so when I read her, you know, the first draft of her section, I went into a mild crisis. I thought to myself, oh my goodness, what am I going to do? Am I just getting out of, you know, like, do I just need to bail on this book? Or, you know, do I need to write this Eucharistic miracle section? And it really kind of turned into this internal struggle. And, you know, when you read her section of the book, it's not completely the like, it's not the same thing that you hear repeated oftentimes about Eucharistic miracles. She makes some good analyses saying, you know what, some of these claims really aren't completely true. Now, that isn't to say that the Eucharistic miracles aren't true. It's just to say that some of the scientific claims are beyond what can really be proven. Hmm. And we got, you know, we both, she had a similar experience to me in which she was like, oh my goodness, how do I deal with this information? And we spent a lot of time praying and thinking about it. And what it came down to is we decided that actually this is an important thing to say for two reasons. First off, we're Christians. We follow Jesus Christ, who is the truth. And so if there is untruth about some of these miracles circulating around, that really needs to be clarified, because this mixing of true statements about the Eucharistic miracles and false statements about the Eucharistic miracles, what it actually does is it makes the entire argument less convincing, because mm-hmm. people can find a couple of things that aren't true, and therefore they can assume that all of it's not true, but that's really not the case. There are a few things that are not true, but a few things that absolutely are true. And then also, you know, we thought about that statement in the Mass, the Mysterium Fidei. In English, it says the mystery of faith. And of course, if you understand the Greek, that word mysterion is the word sacrament. So, you know, the priest consecrates the Eucharist, and then the first thing that he says after that is essentially like, this is the sacrament of faith, right? That's really what he's communicating. And, you know, we can try to put our faith in the science so that there's absolutely nothing, you know, utterly beyond a doubt based on the scientific proofs. But really, you know, faith is of things unseen. Faith comes by hearing. And in a certain sense, to put our faith in the Eucharist because there is a scientific, empirical proof that cannot be doubted in any way is almost, it's a kind of missing the point of the sacrament.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's meant to be the sacrament of faith. Those who can receive it must be those who have the theological virtue of faith. And in a sense, this is the leap, this is the big step that Christ wants us to take in really abandoning ourselves to him. He's abandoned himself completely in the Eucharist to us, and he asks us to abandon our judgment based on our senses to him and to truly trust his word. You know, I think actually reading the book is going to be very interesting, and we decided that actually this is a perfect book when you put all three of those sections together: the biblical proofs, the patristic testimony, and then also this analysis of the Eucharistic miracles that without a doubt says, yeah, some stuff happened here, and you really have to deal with this. However, some of these scientific claims are not quite as tenable as some people like to consider them as.
And Father, I agree with that last point about this leap of faith, because for me, that's how it happened. You know, I was a non-Catholic, but attending my first Catholic Mass, and it was just the grace of God that opened my eyes at the moment of consecration to realize, oh my gosh, that's Jesus Christ. You know, it wasn't a theological argument. It wasn't a vision or anything. It was just this wow, like the scales fell from my eyes, and there was the truth in a Catholic church. So, you know, I think you're right. I just tend to like the science for those who are coming from a very intellectual, you know, bent, and that maybe for them that resonates with them. But I think the point is, what you're saying is, we are called to faith, and faith is not something you can put under the microscope and prove with theories. It is the blind leap, trusting, you know, and hoping in something that we can't, you know, just prove in black and white all the time. Do give me the name again of the book and where people can find this, because it's really fascinating.
Yes, thank you. It's called Behold, It Is I, and it's published by 10 Books. So you can go to 10books.com and pick it up there, or Amazon, or any of the normal platforms that you buy Catholic books on.
And so, Father, do you have a favorite Eucharistic miracle, a personal favorite?
You know, the Bolsena Orvieto miracle is very near and dear to my heart. I was privileged to be able to actually carry the corporal that's held in Orvieto on the Feast of Corpus Christi through the streets of Orvieto as a deacon. And so I just have a very close love for that miracle.
That is a good one. And for me, it was Lanciano. I got to see that. And the thing that struck me is sometimes these relics are held in these reliquaries that are like way above a high altar. They're not that accessible. But the miracle of Lanciano is right there at eye level. And it's also interestingly positioned between this chapel and the greater, the larger church. So we were having a little mass in the chapel. And as the priest was holding up the at the moment of consecration, there's this window, and you could see behind him the reliquary of the miracle. And I know you're not supposed to take a picture during Mass, but I had to take a picture of that because it was so cool. I love the accessibility of Lanciano. And but that did also start, like you said, with there was once was a priest who didn't believe.
Yeah.
So, but yeah. So I guess the final question I want to get to with you, Father Elliott, is, you know, what can we do as Catholics to increase our love and understanding of the Eucharist? Because I think ultimately that's got to be what these miracles are trying to get us to do, is to understand this great gift.
Absolutely, yeah. And I think I would go to just kind of the classic spiritual advice. You know, first off, study, reading good books on the Eucharist, making sure you really understand what it is that we believe about the Eucharist. You can't love what you don't know. Then making sure that you're making a good preparation before Mass and Thanksgiving after Mass. You know, the Mass is really that central moment of encounter with the Eucharist. And then extending that love and devotion from the Mass throughout the day and throughout the week with Eucharistic adoration. With those three things, I can at least testify that my love for the Eucharist grew through those. And you know, that's definitely the wisdom of the saints too.
Yes. And I guess just keeping in mind the fact that the Eucharist is the daily miracle we can all take place in, where it becomes Jesus Christ, body, blood, soul, and divinity. And that is a miracle that happens on every altar in every Catholic church throughout the world till the end of time. So that is a great miracle that we can witness and partake in daily. So Father George Elliott, any new projects or pilgrimages or new works that you want to tell us about?
Yeah, we're actually, so I can't release it. I can't release all the information quite yet, but with CatholicLink.org, we have a new initiative that we're really excited about to, you know, support people in the parishes, revitalize just that missionary spirit across the English-speaking world. And so stay tuned for that. It should be coming out in the next couple of months.
And
CatholicLink.org. Yeah.
Okay, say one more time. What's the link?
It's Catholic-Link.org.
Perfect. Okay. Well, Father, thank you so much for joining us today, talking about Eucharistic miracles. Bless you on all your work, all the good things you're doing, especially out there in the digital world and where you're reaching countless souls for God. We really, really appreciate your vocation, your ministry, and we will be praying for you.
Well, thank you, Elizabeth, and I appreciate everything you guys are doing as well.
All right. God bless. Thanks for joining us today.
God bless.
And that's all the time we have for today's program. So if you missed any of this episode or you want to catch up on past episodes, you can go to ewtn.com/radio and check out the audio archives or download the free EWTN app. And I want to thank my guests today, Dr. Paul Thigpen for talking about spiritual warfare and Father George Elliott for talking about Eucharistic miracles. Now, don't forget to sign up for the newsletter on themiraclehunter.com for more information on miracle stories, where Michael will be speaking next, upcoming book releases, and more. And please pick up a copy of his newest book. It's now available, They Might Be Saints, On the Path to Sainthood in America. And he features 24 blesseds and venerables from this country. And it's published and available through EWTN Religious Catalog at ewtnrc.com. Again, I'm Elizabeth Ficicelli. Michael will be back next week, but meanwhile, it's been a delight to spend this time with you today. And remember, as parishes are reopening for live events, please consider my parish mission, Discovering, Living, and Sharing Our Mission. You can find all about that on my website, elizabethficicelli.com. So thank you today for joining us on The Miracle Hunter, where from claims of healings and visions to the world's most inexplicable events, whether you are a believer or a skeptic, the truth is always worth the hunt. Have a great week. God bless.